we're in a very big political, you know, phase right now. Of course, they got the election 2 weeks from today, and there's so much attention on this. But guys, politics is downstream from culture. Culture is what leads. And what you are doing is so immensely important because you have put your finger on something that needs attention. We have got to get that union of masculine and feminine. And you guys are doing magnificent work. Thank you so very much.
Hello, world. It's me, Dennis. And in search of the new compassionate male, I'm the producer of this podcast, and I'm here with my dear friend, Clay Boykin, the founder of this movement. Hello, Clay.
Hey, Dennis. How are you doing? Boy, I tell you, another great afternoon. We have Paul Higdon with us today. And you know, the situation. Say hi, Paul.
Hey, guys. Hi, Clay. Hey, sorry about that. Good to be with you guys.
I always get so excited. You know, this is one of these situations where back in 2018, I go to the Parliament of the World's Religions. I meet somebody up there, and here we are in 2020. They connect Paul with me, and now here we are. You know, always connecting the dots, and you can never look. You can't connect them going forward, but you can connect them looking backwards.
Isn't it amazing? I mean, that's the power of intention, isn't it, Paul? Yeah. I mean, do you see this? This is a time, Clay and I have talked about this often, that this is a time when we're able to go from zero to make a difference faster than we ever could, because that's the advantage of the interconnected world as much as the challenges of it.
Absolutely, Dennis. And it is a remarkable series of events that has brought us together. And, you know, as we talk here today, there are some other remarkable series of events in my life that has led me also to be here with you and to do things that I never thought possible.
Yeah.
A lot of fabulous dot connecting to be done up here.
Would you talk about some of those dots? Would you share about them, and so that we can see the serendipitously?
Start with Africa.
Oh yeah, well, I will. If it's okay, guys, can I start with the book, because that's the
please.
Most remarkable. Yeah, there's please hold that up.
Recent release, the book is called Hope in a Future. For those who are listening only on a podcast, and there will be a link to that, but go ahead.
Thank you, Dennis, and thanks for holding that up, Clay. I'm going to start, though, by saying one thing. Every single penny that I make off that book goes to vulnerable children. So that's the story here, guys. And let me just talk about some amazing things that happened in my life that led to this book. I just finished a 40-year career in banking. In fact, almost a year ago today, I retired. And it was a wonderful career. I really enjoyed it. And in conjunction or parallel to the last 20 years of my career, I was working in Africa, as you gave me the lead in, Clay. I was working in Africa in a philanthropic organization. And I want to share with you some of the lessons of that as we go through.
Please.
But here's the first day I landed in Africa, what happened and how it became the book. So indulge me a few minutes, guys. It's
please. But make sure and ground us in history, what year it was.
Yeah, exactly. Thanks, Dennis. It was 01. And my wife, Linda, and I went on a humanitarian field trip through East Africa, Kenya, and Tanzania, and we were viewing various projects, orphanages, water wells, trade schools, a variety of things to help uplift the folks there. And the very first day that we arrived, we were still dizzy with jet lag, but we were brought into the slums of Nairobi. The place happens to be called Mathare. And this is one of the most dangerous spots that you can imagine. It is also an incredible slum. It goes on for miles. What I've often said to people is, if you give me 2 hours with you to take you through the slums, you will never see the world the same way.
Yeah.
But the slums at the time in 01 were really impassable for vehicles. So we had to park our vehicle up on a hill, and the orphanage we were visiting sent the older boys to take each of us, escort us, you know, one by one, escort us down the hill to the orphanage. The young man who took my arm, I say, he took it as if he would never let me go, and he never did. I walked down the hill with him, and we went to the orphanage, and after several sort of formalities, to the matron introduced herself. She gave us a quick little orientation to the compound. John, as I learned his name, John took me by the arm, and he said, "Let's go. I'm going to give you my own private tour." So he took me through, you know, the dormitory where he showed me his bed where he slept. He took me up to the classrooms where he showed me an elaborate diagram of photosynthesis. Here I am in the slums, and there's this magnificent diagram of photosynthesis. What's going on here? And, you know, he started telling me about his life. And he told me about how when he was 5 years old, he was thrust onto the streets of the slums. His father had never been around, and his mother had gone insane and just simply left the family. She was non-functioning. And so he and his seven-year-old brother were on the streets of one of the most shocking slums on earth. Well, he started telling me more about his life, and my heart opened and opened and opened to this boy. And we only had a couple of hours together, but you know, it was time to go, but I was taking such a liking to this young man. Here was a young man who was 17 years old at the time, and here was a young man that you could tell was a bright, intelligent young man and not far away from graduating from secondary school. Well, he takes me up the hill, and we're at our van, and we're waiting for others to come, and I'm making small talk, and I said, "John, what would you like to be in life?" And he says, without hesitation, "I want to be a lawyer." And I thought to myself, here's a young man in an impoverished country, living in an orphanage in the slums with no parents. How is this boy going to make it? How is this going to, how is this happening to this young man with such talent, with such heart? And then he looked at me, guys. He looked at me and he said, "Please don't ever forget me." There have never been five or six words uttered to me in my life that have had that effect. And I mean that. I'm not exactly, maybe when Linda said she'd bury me, okay?
Yeah.
Guys, it stunned me. And I got into that van and my heart was breaking for this young man. And so I got in the van, as I describe in the book, we drove away, I look out the back window, and I see John looking down, and then traffic parted us. Well, for the next 12 years, I was working in Africa. As it turns out, the next year, some people came to visit us through an amazing series of events. Another remarkable series of dots connecting, being connected. Remarkable series of events. They came to visit us, and they were opening a children's welfare operation in Nairobi. And by the way, Clay.
Oh my!
No, Clay. You know, your listeners, if they follow all your podcasts, you've done a magnificent one with Karumbo Ringera. She's a friend of mine, and the children's welfare operation, Clay, that you have visited, and Dennis, you and Dennis interviewed Karumbo. It's 3 miles down the road. It's 3 miles down the road from where Karumbo's is.
I just exchanged emails with Karumbo this morning. And yes, she said, "Please, please, please give Paul my best regards."
Oh, Joelle, and right back at her, Clay. I mean, I was just listening to the wonderful, you know, podcast you guys did with her a few months ago, and she was the one I met in Toronto. We didn't get to meet, but I got to see her again. But I got involved in helping start this operation in Meru. children's welfare operation. And Linda and I, my wife and I, would go every year. And I eventually became chairman of the board of trustees. And I served for 6 years, from 12 to 18, as chairman of the board. Well, we hit our 60th birthday in 2013. And so Linda and I, and we're two days apart. She's going out with an older man. I'm 2 days older than her.
Okay? Yeah. Robbing the cradle there, Paul.
There you go, man. Yeah, there you go, Dennis. So we go to a place in the Quebec woods that we found, and just kind of to get away. And I've always loved to write. So I wrote the story for the first time of what I just told you, of going down to the orphanage, of meeting John, of coming back up, and of him, you know, speaking those incredible words, "Please don't ever forget me." And I handed it to Linda and had her read it, because she was there, not the whole time with John and I, but she knew what went on. Because I had told that story to people a few times, but I was always very careful. I did not ever want to cheapen it. I told it to very few people because it was so sacred. Mm-hmm. But I showed it to Linda, and as she was reading it, after she was finished reading it, I said, "This is crazy. Here's this international banker who had this fine career, and yes, I go to Kenya with you, and we do all these things, help found this children's welfare operation. Where is John?
Yeah.
Where's John in all of this? Whatever happened to him? You know, he's now about 30 years old. Where is he?" And then I said to Linda, "I got to find him. I've got to find him." So, and here's the dots come in. Here's where the dots come in, my buddies. It was actually a month later. I was called to the Children's Welfare Operation. It's called Ripples International. And Ripples, the name comes from the rippling effect that charity work and good work in the community, the rippling effect it'll have for the community. Yes. That's where the name comes from. So I was called there because they were doing a very big event. In fact, it was the Kenyan marathoners were running. It was the second team, but I mean, the second team in America. Yeah, okay. So they're only the fifth and sixth best in the world, okay? So these guys were running for a charity, and the governor of the state and the senator of the state were going to be there. And so me as chairman, I had to be there. And so on the spur of the moment, I found a plane. I, you know, flew over there, and I went by myself because Linda and I were going to go back in a couple months, and it didn't make sense to do both of us round trips. So I got there in Nairobi at 3 in the morning. And, you know, I lived in Mexico City for a long time, and I know you can't just show up in one of these cities and expect that any old cab driver is going to take you, you know, to your hotel. You got to be very careful. Well, it's a funny part. I write this up in the book. It's a bit of a funny bunch of funny stuff that happens. But eventually this one very nice, well-dressed young man agrees to take me to my hotel. And we get to talking. And I'm asking about his life. And he says, "Yeah, well, I lived in Western Kenya, but I was moved to Nairobi when my father took work here." And I said, "Well, where did you live?" He said, "I lived in Mathari." I said, "Wait a minute. Mathari, that's the name of the slum I visited, you know, 12 years, 13 years ago." He said, "Yeah." I said, "Okay, do you know the orphanage called Good Samaritan?" He says, "Everyone knows Good Samaritan Orphanage. It does such magnificent work, and there's so many orphans off the streets in Mathari that live there. Everyone knows Good Samaritan." I said, "Okay, my friend, do you know John Mina?" His last name is Mina. He said, "I don't know John Mina." I said, "I'll tell you what. Can you go to Good Samaritan and please see if you can find anything to do with John Mina? I met him 12 years ago, 13 years ago, and I'd like to see him again." And of course, this taxi driver, very potent. You haven't seen this guy in that long and you want to find what? But he was a very open-spirited young man, and he agreed to do it. Okay. "But I can't go with you because I got to be up in Nehru for business the next day. So, you know, please just let me know." So I gave him my you know, contact information. I'm up in Nehru a couple days later. My BlackBerry buzzes. I look at it. It's for Martin, the taxi driver. I found John Miner. Found John Miner. Just to finish, guys, and turn it back to you. A month or two later, Linda and I do that trip that we had planned. And working through Martin, the cab driver, we went down, and John and I were reunited. And we have been reunited ever since November of 13.
My goodness.
Yeah. It's unbelievable.
And so you're in contact with him.
Yeah. I know, yeah. You know one of the things that I'm sure of in this life is that there's no such thing as a one-way blessing. That if I give something to someone and I do not receive the joy and receive the complete repayment at the instant of the gift, then there's something wrong with my receptors. I need to clean my receptors and do the openness of your heart, of him knowing what that did to your heart to reunite with John.
Thank you, Dennis. I'll talk a little bit more about that, but just Clay, I need to answer your question. John and I have a standing call every Thursday morning, 9 a.m. Central Time.
Wonderful.
John and I are now father and son.
Yes.
African sense. Mm-hmm. You know, when he first started, because we have been together since 2012, and along the way, I learned a little bit more about his life story, and that's when I said, I have got to write your story. And if I could just, for listeners, frame up the book a little.
Please do, yes.
The opening chapters are what I just related here. You guys kind enough to give me the floor to talk about going down, Linda and I, my birthday, having to find him, and Martin the taxi driver. That's the opening. But the bulk of the book is the story of his life on the streets. And guys, you can't make it up. It is not only the most remarkable story of a roller coaster existence, but it's a story of unbelievable perseverance, of unbelievable courage to exist and I won't say thrive, but to exist in these circumstances.
Exactly.
It is just shocking. It is shocking what this young man's been through, and yet how he has come out at the other end whole. I couldn't do it. Oh, I don't think I could do it.
Do you see something, Paul, in the colonialism mindset of us wanting to go over there and help them and lift them up, that is so wrong that we have to rethink, because they already have the brilliance and the wisdom, and that we have as much to learn as we have to give.
Yeah. Let me just take that in two parts, if I may, Dennis, and let me just talk a little bit about the last comment on the book, and then I want to talk about some of the lessons I've learned about colonialism.
Please.
The implicit theme that runs throughout the book, and I never say it, I never once write it down, but the implicit theme that runs through the book is, no matter who you are, no matter what is your station in life, you have a gift. You have a gift to give us. Will we listen? And will we receive your treasure? John has, whatever I've given John, it is nothing compared to the lessons I have learned by knowing this young man's life. It doesn't matter. You know, we get all haughty about, well, I'm a banker. And he's only a street boy. God, knock that off, man.
Exactly. There is the hierarchical going. This is where we're working about the hierarchy, Clay. And because so much of the, we have spent the time in this hierarchical male the patriarchy, this that served us to get us so far, but very much like the booster of a rocket only takes you so far before the second stage must take hold, and we must create something new that will allow us to get it to where we're going.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, Dennis, if I could go back to your comment about colonialism, look.
Please.
One of the things that I've learned the hard way and for making a lot of mistakes is, look, these folks know what they need. Come in there with your doggone solution. Preposterous.
What a brilliant way to frame it. It's so clear.
These are intelligent people who have survived things that none of us would probably, you know, again, ever get through. And so, you know, they may need financial resources. They may need some, you know, some suggestions. But the idea that we can come in there and give them, you know, tell them what to do is preposterous. The other thing that I think is so important, that again, it's kind of a funny thing, Dennis. Who's saving who?
Oh,
who's saving?
Well
who?
Said, Paul.
You know, I mean, one of the things is: are we assuaging our own consciences? Are we saving ourselves by trying to save them? Yeah. It's all preposterous. Yeah. Now, the other thing I know is: look, my view of humanity is: look, we're neither saints nor sinners. We're okay, and there is no pure motive for which you do things. There's always some selfishness, some selflessness. That's fine. But okay, let's make sure we don't make it all a selfish endeavor so that I get to go and, you know, put on my coffee table all these pictures of the slums so that everyone can see what a neat guy I am. Come on.
Yeah.
Get off that. Yeah. You know, these are incredibly talented people, and you know, we need to honor and respect that. And my God, the lessons I have learned, I wouldn't trade for him.
Where do I pick up? You know, Karambu said that, you know, he's, and I, when she first said it, it kind of threw me back. She says, Clay, I don't want your money. I want you to come work with me. Now that's, you know, that's making the point. Of course there's money and financial, but to sit back here and lob dollar bills across the water thinking that we're making a difference. No. And I just spent 3 weeks there in Meru last year. And I say just 3 weeks. It was a lifetime of experience.
Yes.
And I can't get back there fast enough. I love the people, and you're right. They're just the brilliance is.
Yeah, absolutely. And how we impoverish ourselves by not opening ourselves up to the wisdom of all.
Let me ask you. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Please.
Let me ask you something.
Yeah.
So, all the work that you've done there, and with the kids and young adults and so forth, the lessons there, and we've got kids and young adults here. What can we learn?
Yeah. Oof. Yeah. Let me tell you one of the big lessons that came out of this, Clay, and I hope it addresses what you're asking. You know, John calls me Dad. I think I mentioned that before. And you know, we get real fastidious about, well, it's not bloodlines, and oh, you know, and I finally learned, no. You know, in Africa, where community is everything, in ways we can't appreciate here anymore. Mm-hmm. It's very hard to appreciate for many of us. You know, they call mom and dad. They have a number of moms and dads. Mm. They have all kinds of brothers and sisters who live on the street with them or live in their little village. But here's the thing, and I hope this is what answers your question, Clay. Are you paying attention? Because Linda and I, my wife and I, are the only adults who have consistently paid attention to John. And that That young man has told me how he has spiritually flourished in ways that I don't appreciate, but I've come to learn that it is paying attention. And yes, guidance, and yes, you know, clothe them and feed them, but I think that just makes all the difference in the world.
Yeah.
I so agree. And we understand that from the quantum level, that whatever you pay, and what I've learned in my life, Paul, and Clay, you've demonstrated this too, is that whatever we pay attention to grows.
Mm.
Pay attention to fear.
Yeah, yeah.
Pay attention to negativity.
Yeah.
Pay attention to whatever it is, whatever the old axiom of whichever wolf, you know, the one you feed, and that's what we get an opportunity to do. And you have chosen to pay attention here. Have you noticed, it appears to me, and again, you have to understand, white male privileged background, so that I have a different perspective on this, and I'm also wired in optimistically. There still, even with all that taken away, there feels like that there is a shift in consciousness going on the planet, that we are connecting, that something is happening, that is happening there and here and all around. And I'd love for you to share about it.
Sure. No, thank you. I'm not a psychologist. I'm not an anthropologist. I'm not a sociologist. I'm just a guy with some hunches. So let me just play some hunches here. First of all, there's nothing to me inherently wrong about masculine energy. There's nothing inherently wrong about it. There's nothing inherently wrong with feminine energy. And in fact, it's when the two unite that you get the best solutions. And whether it's a solution or a project, or, you know, when we physically unite and create a beautiful child, the merging of those energies is critical. And I may mangle this, but I used to study Eastern religions before, and I remember something that has stuck with me for years. The head without the heart has no animation. The heart without the head has no direction. And it's, you know, metaphors for the male and the female orientations. And I think, you know, it's when you get those two working together that you have the animation and direction. So, I mean, I think that, as we work more together, this is really, this is what we need to be working towards. And of course, we all have both masculine and feminine within us. Please, Dennis, I'm sorry.
Well, I want to pick up on that.
This is Clay. This is, are you kidding?
I want to go back to our conversation with Howard. And he was talking about the solar-lunar connection. The solar male and the solar masculine, the lunar masculine, the solar feminine, the lunar feminine.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple of points that the solar masculine and the solar feminine are not the same. Yeah, they are the solar energy or the male energy, but they present
differently.
Mm. The same with the lunar masculine and the lunar feminine. It's the lunar energy, if you want to, either, you know, metaphor or not, but we present differently. And it supports what you're saying. And when the one thing that he said that really stopped me in my tracks, he said, yeah, and in this, the lunar leads and the solar executes. That's exactly what you just said.
And the fuel, the driving fuel, I believe that I have come to believe that makes it work is compassion.
Yeah.
And that's why Clay, and then Clay, you have this, and aren't you seeing this, that this is really the place that makes all this be able to work?
Yeah. And it's, you know, I talk about it every day, every man I meet, there's this burn, there's this void, you know, there's something down there that we can't describe and we don't have the language to describe it. And the whole patriarchy is pushed down and we're not, you know, so we don't have the, you know, and it's our, call it our lunar masculine that we said, turn away from that. But until we've integrated our lunar and solar, we're not a complete male.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that down there, that there is, right. is the heart of compassion.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, you've made a commitment, Paul, to grow. You've made a commitment. You sat there and said, okay, well, that's just fine. I'm not going to try to fix the outside world. I'm going to work on my inside world.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah. And I'd like to, if I may, guys, I'd like to mention a little bit about my wife, because she has been a beacon to me, but also I've been a beacon to her. And,
wonderful.
And, yeah, I mean.
What is her first name, Paul?
Her name is Linda. Her Please. Name is Linda. And you know, she's been with me through Africa for all these times. We had a midlife marriage in our 40s and, you know, have been, you know, together for 20-odd years. But, you know, it's interesting. And this actually just happened the other day in the car. You know, she kind of blew the whistle. She, you know, the relationship, there's some issues here that we've got to discuss. Okay. But the great thing, back up a moment. The book is dedicated to Linda.
Mm-hmm.
And you read the, you know, you read the dedication page. And the third thing that I mention is the great spirit open to all of life. And the thing, guys, that she does so well is when she blows the whistle, she's not blowing the whistle at me and calling me on the carpet. She's calling us on the carpet. Saying we collectively have got to do these things better. And I think, yeah, and yeah, and it's, and see, this is the, to me, the spiritual integrity that she has that has been such a beacon to me. And of course, she'll turn around and say, I can't navigate this world without you. I'm using shorthand. But, you know, these are where we bring our separate gifts. And this is the thing that drives me a little bit nuts, guys. I do want to talk a little about the patriarchy. I've listened to many of your podcasts. One thing that I haven't heard, and maybe it was, I just haven't listened to enough of them, but there is a lot of fear in the patriarchy. Oh, there is a lot of fear.
Beautifully said.
Fear of losing their status. There is, you know, the pathology is the hardened heart. Okay. The pathology is, and there are various things that drive, you know, one to have the hardened heart, but you know, there's a fear of losing status.
Yes.
Think about it. How fragile is a man's ego if he can't do some dishes, if he can't, you know, help with the children, how fragile, mm-hmm. fearful are you if you have to, if you recoil from those simple things or not support your life partner in her endeavors?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know,
or have to
they require some courage,
or have to accumulate hundreds of lifetimes of wealth, mm-hmm. and it still not be enough.
Yes, thank you.
To be able to be, because that's another part of our fragility. That's a fragility that is within us that says that I have to have that.
Absolutely. And these are just accoutrements. These are externalities that bolster what sometimes is an inner fragility, an inner fear.
Yeah.
It will sometimes issue in domestic violence.
Mm-hmm. Acting Absolutely. Out in
ways that just, it's a sickness. And, you know, getting back to what you were saying, yeah, guys, this is breaking down. You know, men are no longer, you know, they're challenged by women at work. Whites are challenged by people of color.
They're
just, you know, the easy street anymore.
Yeah. You know,
we're going to get there. We're going to get there.
You know, I want to pick up a little bit more on patriarchy. One of the things that I've learned over the past couple of years Again, going back to the Parliament of the World's Religions, I met two fine people who have the organization Gender Equity and Reconciliation International, Will Keepin and Cynthia Briggs. And I collaborate with them as a result of the Parliament. And one of the most profound things that I knew in my heart, but I didn't know in my head until they really said it, was that the patriarchy has wounded both men and women, where nobody gets out of this. And to be able to bring people, and that's what they do. They bring people together in a very sacred and safe setting to really recognize that, I'm the privileged white Western male and I've got everything going for me. Well, I'm wounded too by the patriarchy. And this is not comparing wounds. This is not whose wound is worse. It's none of that. Just the sheer nature of the fact that that woundedness that we both carry, both women and men carry, is our common ground. And this isn't to say that there isn't anything good with the patriarchy. I mean, the patriarchy has gotten us where we are today. I say good and bad.
Right.
But let's recognize that we're in this together, people.
Yeah.
You know, Linda and I ran across a remarkable presentation. It was at Howard University. It was quite a number of years ago. But it was two gentlemen, guys about our age, actually, maybe in their, you know, maybe a little bit younger. But one, the son of one of the fathers, had murdered the son of the other. The young boy was a pizza delivery man, and he was driving to deliver a pizza. And the other young man was a gang member and had to do the deed in order to be included in the gang. And the pizza delivery young man, he was killed. And the young boy who shot him spent life in jail. And these two fathers reconciled and made peace, and they go around the country, you know, talking about forgiveness. But here's the thing that I will never forget. There are victims at both ends of the gun. Mm-hmm. There are victims at both ends of the gun.
Yeah.
And just like you say, Clay, you know, the patriarchy, both are wounded.
Exactly. And to really to understand, Paul, what I love about your story and about what you did is that you were able to go into there and say, I can experience your wealth, John. I can experience, I'm here to experience as a peer, as an equal, because if we know anything about what the reason why I understand the fear in the patriarchy, because it says that the pie is only so big, and if I give one sliver to someone else, it's going to come out of my cut. When it's actually synergistic. It's actually that if I empower you and if I give you something, certainly, hey, 1948, Detroit Pistons won the NBA title. There was a full Caucasian team. Now, while they were talented basketball players, some of them in the Hall of Fame, they would have had to up their game to play against the Lakers.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, so we are going to have to up our game. I'm certainly understanding that we white males have to up our game, but there are so many benefits to healing this wound.
We need to listen without judgment. You know, thank you, Dennis, for saying, you know, about, you know, how I wrote this. My objective was to listen to John and to relate without judgment the life in the slums. Without judgment. And the frames about, you know, me meeting him and me being reunited, and I mean, and I would like to read at some point just one, two little paragraphs. But those are my lessons. But I'm not going to impose my you know, white male privileged thinking on John or the son. That's crazy. That just doesn't work.
No.
Take the beautiful treasures that this young man's life offers. That's what's important.
So you just mentioned something about a couple of paragraphs.
Is that okay if I just read you?
Would you please?
Oh, that life would service. Be honored.
Yeah, please do.
Thank you so much, guys. These are towards the end. And, you know, as I've said here, I did service for many years in philanthropies. You guys are doing a magnificent service here for so many souls. But let me just read you, you know, a couple of things. As I came to learn, the path of service is not without its challenges. When we encounter privation, it is all too easy to look away, to recoil from life's ugliness. There have been embarrassingly too many occasions on which I have walked away. Emotionally closing down feels safe, and I have chosen emotional safety more than I care to admit. I have turned my gaze from human suffering, seeking refuge in spiritual complacency. Fearful of feeling hurt, I have sought the security of mute comfort. But I slowly came to discover the great rewards come from opening one's heart to all of life, its transcendent joys and ubiquitous suffering. Embracing the happenstance of privileged circumstance, along with the casualty of unfortunate birthplace. None of us will ever alleviate the world's suffering, but we can contribute to making it better.
Mm.
That is some fine writing, Paul. That is some really beautiful. This is coming from This is coming from two writers. We're both writers, Clay and I, and so we understand wordsmithery. That is some finely carved out sentences and beautiful and clear sentiment.
Thank you so much, Dennis. That means a lot. And I enjoyed, you know, writing it immensely. It's one of the immense privileges of my life to have met John and to be close to that young man. And my life is richer for it.
So how do you look in your windshield now, Paul? What are the kinds of things that are tingling your intuition and the next left or right turns that you might that might impel you?
Yeah, thanks so much, Dennis. Well, in conjunction with writing the book, I created the Little Boost Children's Fund. And I will read you one tiny snippet as to where that strange name came from, Little Boost. But just to finish for a moment, yeah, the motto or the mission is giving vulnerable kids a little boost. And we have a foundation which the IRS has granted us not-for-profit status. It took a long time to get that. Lots of questions had to be answered to our friends at the IRS. But we have a wonderful, talented board that in both the United States, that's particularly where we work, where we will give contributions to children, but a couple of key things, contributions to vulnerable children, local solutions. We're not imposing our solutions. It's local solutions. And, we take not a penny out of it. All of the overhead is separately funded. So every dime that anyone gives goes right to the kids. And, now, I'm going to read just one other very short little piece to tell you where this funny name, Little Boost, comes from. I've written the whole story of John's life, the amazing story of John's life, the ups and the downs. We've been reunited. We're together. And he's told me his whole story. And the very last sentences of the book go like this. This is John speaking. There are many people in Mathari, the slum, who had better dreams than me. They wished to be doctors or pilots, and they tried their level best. But no one gave them a boost. That's what most of us need, Dad, just a little boost. And that's what where the name comes from. And those are John's words. I walk through the slums. I can't tell you how many hours. I had a little handheld recorder that John spoke into. And there were about 300 audio tracks that I transcribed and pieced together to create the book. But those are John's exact words. All we need, Dad, is just a little boost. And that's what we're dedicated to doing, guys, is to giving kids a little boost. The kids in need. And we're doing Indian reservations here, pre-Hispanic kindergartens, both of those in the U.S. We're doing street boy homes in Kenya. You know, but we're following their lead. We're following their lead.
This is so inspirational, Paul. Thank you. Thank you so much for the opportunity, because what I'm certainly seeing is that I'm at 72. I am in a significant growth phase. I'm in a place where I am learning. Nobody ever told me. I thought the 70s were supposed to be some time of stasis or some time of sitting back. Well, I'm finding out that it's an all hands on deck time. It's time that let's get the hell in there. And all of us, we're in this for the country. We're in this for the world and everybody. And that's what diversity means. Diversity means we must have the elders involved as much as you have the children involved, all of us.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I remember telling someone many years ago, probably I was in my 40s, I said, I want to be younger when I'm in my 70s and 80s than I was in my 20s.
I want to pick up on that point, because I have a dear friend, and a couple of years ago, we had coffee, and she had just turned 70. And so we hadn't seen each other for a while, and I said, so what are you up to right now? Now, what are you doing? She said, well, I'm reinventing myself for the next 30 years.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I never thought about that. And I thought, well, that's pretty far reaching there. But no, it's not. And if we're not reinventing ourselves, that was a message to me, Clay. If you're not reinventing yourself daily, you're backing up.
Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly, because the world is evolving. We must evolve with it. That's, yes. You can't just sit back and say, well, I've done fine. I have a metaphor that retirement is like the Indianapolis 500. You pull in, put on four more tires, and get back out onto the track.
Nicely said.
Yeah.
Listen, guys, if I could just you know, just a final comment. I want to thank you immensely personally for having me on the show, but I want to congratulate the two of you, because you are changing culture. You are changing culture. And, you know, it's interesting. We're in a very big political, you know, phase right now. Of course, we got the election 2 weeks from today, and there's so much attention on this. But guys, politics is downstream from culture. Culture is what leads. And what you are doing is so immensely important, because you have put your finger on something that needs attention. We have got to get that union of masculine and feminine. And you guys are doing magnificent work. Thank you so very much.
We're here giving voice to people who know that. And we all know that in our hearts. We just need to be reminded of it. And that's what you're also doing.
This is what is so, so wonderful about meeting you, Paul, and spending time with you, is because you have revalidated everything that we are saying in our own ways. And like each instrument in the orchestra is going to give a different note and a different tonality to the symphony that we're doing. We're all separate instruments, but the harmony that we're bringing to this, what we're doing to amplify this, is extraordinary. And that's what you're doing with your book. this is what you're doing with your the Little Boost Foundation, with the work that you're doing, and all the adventures that are going to come with you and Linda, the collaboration of what you said. I just love the idea that I would come and there's a problem in the relationship. So in this is our problem. It's not your problem. This is us. We're going to that to me, they just completely shifted in a new way. I've gotten so many gifts from you, Paul, and the connection to John and the connection to Linda, and through this is really, as we had said at the beginning, our intention was we wanted to exit this conversation at the higher level of consciousness that we entered it. Mission accomplished.
Yep, mission accomplished.
Guys, you're very kind. Thank you indeed.
Indeed. All right. Thank you, everyone, for listening to another podcast of In Search of the New Compassionate Male, with Paul Higdon as our guest, Clay Boykin, my wonderful Clay, who is our founder and the leader of the In Search of Movement, and me, who gets to produce this podcast. I'm Dennis Tardon. We will see you next time.